Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a timely free resource with you. When you look at the headlines, war, instability, constant talk about the end times, it's easy to feel anxious or unsure what to think. But the Bible offers a better way. Our short guide, Watchful, Not Worried, End Times, the Second Coming, and How to Read the News with Biblical Hope, will help you understand what Scripture really says about the end times, so you can live with clarity, hope, and confidence instead of fear. You'll discover how to read the news through the lens of Scripture, avoid speculation, and stay grounded in God's bigger story. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. I am delighted to be joined today by Jim Stockton, Emeritus Lecturer in Philosophy at Boise State University in Idaho. He's recently written a very exciting new book, The Oxford University Socratic Club, 1942 to 1972, A Life. We're going to be talking to Jim about his work, as well as sharing a paper and a workshop that he presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Jim's paper was Beside the Meetings, the Oxford University Socratic Club's Lesser Known Events. And the title of his workshop there was Research Opportunities and the Oxford University Socratic Club, 1942 to 1972. How significant a role did C.S. Lewis play in the Oxford University Socratic Club?
The club wouldn't be what I am writing about right now, or as famous as it, ended up becoming without Lewis. Now, you could have had a philosophy club with quite a few philosophical superstars of the day. Again, going back up to the Moral Sciences Club, you've got Wittgenstein up there off and on doing some wonderful philosophy, but causing quite a bit of trouble. And there were other philosophy clubs that also, did pretty well themselves. My argument is from 1942 to 1972, but mostly from 1942 to about 1965, 66, the Socratic is one of the most popular speaking clubs in the Oxford community. And you got to give Lewis the credit for making it what it was. From 1942 to about 52, maybe some would say maybe, closer to 51. He's the person everyone is hoping to hear when they come to the meeting. Not everyone, but definitely a lot of the students are. And he engages quite a few of the other academic, personalities of Oxford at the time. And it made for a lot of lively, fun meetings. And he was very good in his role as advisor. And as that role, he was often asked to open up the discussion section. And the way that not only Lewis, but most of the people who opened up the discussion section put that out there was they would make a reply. They would offer a quick critique to what had just been read or shared with the club. There were some meetings where they had formal replies in the first year. A guy named Robert Eisler and Austin Farr, they had formal replies to each other's position on whether or not Christ rise from the dead and some other key questions. But yeah, so I would say definitely up through 1948, he was kind of the personality that kept it going. He was really very animated, and I think he was a lot of fun. He spoke quite a bit, but, to be fair to him, because a couple of the other people in Oxford did, kind of criticized Lewis of using the club, an undergraduate club, for his own apologetic platform. But the people came to hear Lewis. And as president, it was his, you know, duty to open up the discussion if there was no one else there to give the reply to someone's paper or talk. So that's how he ends up talking so much. And sometimes what he has to say in the comments, we have minutes where you have a speaker, they talk for about a half hour or read a paper. You have another philosopher, another academic, give a somewhat semi-formal reply. They, you know, kind of go back and forth a little bit. And then you hear Lewis jump in. And, you know, a little of that reminds you of the guy at the conference that, you know, that he goes to every session and he always has to talk. But, you know, to be fair to Lewis, you know, one, it is, you know, he is the senior advisor of the club. But two, he had a lot to say. He was not shy. And I think that one of the things that my book features is that side of his personality. And I do think that the Lewis scholars and biographers are going to find some worth in this text. The philosophers less so.
Jim, you said that when you alphabetized some of the people who were involved in the club, there was an outstanding list. Would you just share who some of those other members were?
Oh, yeah. Tony Flew, Erez, Basil Mitchell, Price, Hodges. We also have the younger philosophers show up in the early 50s. You got Bernard Williams, Alistair McIntyre, Eric Mascal, who was more of a philosophical theologian, Austin Farr, also a philosophical theologian. Those guys were, you know, doing great work during the 50s. And shy of having to jump over to my cheat sheet here, those are the ones that first come to mind. I do have a story that might share the idea a little bit better than myself just rambling on. When I first went to Oxford, you know, I went to my department, and I'm not tenured. I never was tenured, nor do I have a doctorate. So I had to go to the fellows in my department who were tenured and, you know, pretty much governed the budget, and asked them for money to travel to Oxford. And they said, well, why are you going? And I go, well, I'm going to go there and do some research on the Socratic Club that Lewis was the advisor for. And philosophers get that. They were going, H.D. Lewis? C.I. Lewis? Not David Lewis. He's far too young, and he's an American. So, you know, there were a lot of Lewises at the time, and they were teasing me. And the first thing one of them said was, well, you know, it's not really a philosophical body of research. I mean, Lewis is a literary man. And I said, oh, yeah, no doubt about it. I'm not arguing Lewis is a philosopher. I've never made that argument. I go, but look at who the members of the club were. And I showed them my alphabetized list. And they were just, you're kidding. No, he was there? Oh, I always wondered about if he had said anything about that. And by the time they got done looking at all of the philosophers on the list, they helped fund my travel, which to me was just so generous. Because, you know, full-time, basically I was a teacher, full-time lecturers in America seldom get, you know, big travel money.
Oh, well, I'm so pleased you got to do that. One of the things that struck me when I was reading through some of the things that you'd written, Jim, was just how many significant female philosophers there were as well. I mean, how noteworthy is it that so many women were involved in the Socratic Club?
Well, the Socratic Club was began at Somerville College in Michaelmas, is it? The autumn term? And at the first, and I show this in the second chapter of the book, or it might be the first chapter, I think I show this. It started as a women's society. And women's speaking societies, women's parliaments, women's philosophy clubs, they were all in effect from the beginning when the women colleges were established. And England has a wonderful history of speaking societies. And I actually had about 7 or 8 pages on that, the beginning of the book. And people who were reading the book with me as I was writing it said I should just drop that. But so it started out as a women's speaking society. It quickly, by the second meeting, was accepting men as members. I think they realized they had to do that if they wanted the university recognition. In other words, they could do it if it was just Somerville College. They couldn't do it as the Oxford University Club. At least that's my assumption. I think it's a pretty good one. And all the young women that had spoken to Stowe all week earlier went to the meetings. And I have this one section where I make the point. All of a sudden, what happened was the young women were going to the early, the first meetings. And at one of the meetings back in the fall term, they asked if they can bring their boyfriends. And that's what really started to make things popular. Because in 1942, if you were an 18 or 19 year old college student at Somerville, you had to go through the matrons. And they weren't going to be very amenable to the idea of just going out with some young men. But if 4 guys show up to escort 8 of the women from Somerville over to C.S. Lewis's and Pastor Allwinkle's speaking club, everyone's okay with that. So for the first year, it became a place for the men and the women to meet. It also became a place where a lot of the people that were passing through Oxford because of the war went to. It was kind of one of the must-go-to places if you were only there for a few months. So the women continued to be the ones who found places to hold meetings, gather dues, take care of the daily, you know, or the weekly business of running the club. The great majority, not the great majority, but the majority of the meetings were held at the women's colleges. And that continued all the way up through the 50s. And then in after World War II, there are a group of women philosophers who end up becoming very famous, and that's Anne Scholl. A lot of Lewis people know about her. She's absolutely one of the most brilliant philosophers in the 20th century, as was her friend of Philippa Foot, if I'm pronouncing her first name correctly. I probably am not.
No, I think so.
But then there was Iris Murdoch and Mary Midgley. A little bit later on, Helen Oppenheimer and Mary Warnock joined those women. These women primarily taught ethics and other introductory level courses that the men who were engaged in other venues of philosophy didn't want to teach. So because PP&E had ethics as a prerequisite to the program, that's what happened with the workload being assigned to them. And they found the Socratic Club to be much more receptive. The club, as for both genders, for all folks, was a very good place to go read your paper first at, and then go read your paper at the Joette Society or the Aristotelian Society, because people there were, you know, They weren't trying to help you critique your paper and prep it for publication. They just wanted to know if you were going to talk about something interesting and preferably something religious. And, but they welcomed all sorts of different conversations.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
If you've ever struggled to fully understand the New Testament or explain your faith with confidence, you're not alone. That's exactly why Premier Insight exists and why your support matters right now. When you give today, we'll send you a special thank you gift, The New Testament You Never Knew Bible Study Guide by N.T. Wright. It will help you understand the context, meaning, and story of Scripture more clearly. And your support helps others do the same through programs like this. So please give your best gift today and request your copy. Just go to premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. Thank you for helping people engage God's Word with wisdom and understanding.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. And do we know if there were any members of the Socratic Club that became key friends in C.S. Lewis's life?
Forrest, probably the best example. He was good friends with Price, who he met in his undergraduate days. And that's something out there that I haven't seen anybody write about. And not only was their friendship outside the Socratic Club a significant friendship for Lewis as well as Price, but at the club, they shared papers back and forth, and they had a really good time. You could tell when you're reading Price's more skeptical and empirically grounded arguments, which aren't necessarily friendly to Christianity, replying to or going up against Lewis's sometimes hyper-rational Christian apologetics. I'm being a little sarcastic there. He was a pretty good rationalist for a literary critic. I'll give him that. But they enjoyed the exchanges. And I hope someone out there, you know, picks that up and goes with it. And if they need primary materials from the club minutes and what else I have, I'll be more than happy to share. There were other friends that he made along the way, as well as he made a couple enemies too. and then there were people that you would think he would never have gotten along with, you know, like Ayres, you know. And Ayres shows up to the club, and Ayres was tough. You know, he was feisty and really enjoyed a good argument and kind of a take no prisoners type of guy when he was speaking. And Lewis showed some admiration for him, and I think they got on well enough. But he was more fond of, you know, for example, Michael Foster, who was also from Ayres College, and he was a Christian philosopher. He made quite a few contributions to the club.
Well, and you say in your book that meeting of Foster and Ayer, where they're discussing, I think it's belief and reason in philosophy, is one of the better examples of Christian and atheistic arguments going up against one another. And it reminded me, I think, of some of the debates that we saw with the new atheist movement. And I think sometimes people have a tendency to think that the kind of classic debates between Christians and atheists is perhaps a new thing, but actually they were really setting the groundwork for it at the Oxford University Socratic Club, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Philosophy coming out of World War I in particular took an atheistic turn. Most of the people in philosophy in the 1920s and 30s were either Anglican Christians who were very quiet and reserved about their faith. They didn't really see it as something that needed to be a part of their academic or scholarly studies. There were a lot more people in the 20s and 30s than there were in the 40s and 50s that were doing philosophical theology and philosophy of religion. So that was one of the transitions that went on during the mid-20th century. But the idea behind the club, and Lewis talks about this in his preface to the First Socratic Digest, was that Christians and atheists would go at it on the stage. And he jokes that they couldn't find enough atheists in Oxford to really bring this about. But there were a few meetings that were just that, where you had a person who was deeply committed to religion, and you had someone who was just as committed to atheism, or the more popular way of putting it would be atheism with a very strong grounding in science. And a lot of those philosophers at that time, they saw themselves as defending science just as much as they were defending whatever atheistic position they had. And they also didn't want to see philosophy become the handmaiden of theology and religion. And the person who probably had the most effect on that change was Bertrand Russell. And there's a very famous essay called The Value of Philosophy. It's actually chapter 15 of his book on the problems of philosophy. And he says right out, if we continue, you know, serving, you know, the big colleges of theology, as science marches forward, we'll be left behind. And a lot of young philosophers agreed with that. But, you know, it wasn't as atheistic as it was, as it's sometimes painted. It, like I said, a lot of people just kept quiet. And then there were a few people, and Mary Warnock, for example, she identified in this way. And I hope it's Warnock. Sometimes I get my philosophers confused. She called herself a atheistic Anglican. And I brought that up at the conference, and I noticed that Michael Ward was shaking his head going, yes. So Michael Ward knows more about that tradition than I do. And I need something to talk to him about it, because I just find it to be very intriguing. You know, you don't hear that in the American academic community. You know, I'm an atheist Catholic, you know, for example.
We have a lot of that in the UK, actually. Richard Dawkins famously calls himself, I think he's even gone as far as calling himself a cultural Christian now.
Yeah.
He certainly admits to singing hymns in the shower and going to Evensong. So that is quite a common thing in the UK, to not believe in God at all, be totally atheistic when it comes to your beliefs. But actually, there's something about the trappings around Christianity that are quite attractive to British
people.
And the
one about him singing in the shower, my father-in-law and mother-in-law were both Lutheran ministers. I remember my father-in-law telling me, the last thing the atheist will give up is singing, is the hymns and the choir. And he would say, I had many atheists in my choir, and that was the only reason they kept coming to church. And I think that does make a difference for a lot of people. I know that I really enjoy church music myself.
Jim, you mentioned there the Socratic Digests. Would you just explain a little bit about what they are?
Yes, they were five paper-bound publications, and they were either the minutes of the meetings, just right there in print. They've been brushed up a bit, and that pretty much was the going content of the first and the second Socratic Digest. Or what happened in the third, fourth, and fifth digest, people would go deliver a paper or give a talk at the Socratic, then they would go back, write a formal paper, and then they would publish it in the digest. And the digest was well received by the philosophical community. A lot of people in philosophy appear to have wanted to publish in the digest. And again, it's progressive. As you get closer to the end of the 40s, you get more and more philosophical content in the digest, and especially in the fourth and the fifth digest. And they're important in that it gives us a good understanding of what philosophy and philosophical theologians wanted to talk about during this time in Oxford's history. And I also believe that there was a little bit of a tug of war, a little bit of a battle, and I write about that in my book, between Aldwinkle. And at that time, Lewis has kind of taken a step back from being engaged in contentious arguments. And this is, you know, in the late 40s. And Farrar, the two of them, are pushing back against the philosophical communities when it comes to public, what goes in the Socratic Digest, as well as what was being shared at the meetings. Now, philosophy at this time loved certain words to describe the problems that they were engaged in. And Bernard Williams, Bertrand Russell, Wittgenstein, some of these other guys would talk about philosophical muddles and philosophical, you know, problems being, you know, difficult to work through in their mind. And Farrar and Aldwinkle fired right back with their own ideas on that. And then finally, in the fifth Socratic Digest, Aldwinkle pens off a rather feisty preface to it. And you can see she's conceited. And she's realized that the digests are going to be primarily philosophical papers. But that was coming much earlier than 1952, when the fifth and last issue was published. And then there were two very important books that came out in the 50s, with many of the people contributing to them. They were both anthologies, being club members. And one is New Essays in Philosophical Theology, and there's Tony Flew and Alistair MacIntyre were the editors. MacIntyre holding up the Christian side of the platform, and Flew, who was a rather famous atheistic speaker from the beginning of his career forward for quite a while. And then there's a debate as to whether or not he converted in the latter part of his life, which I don't go into in the book because I just didn't want to go there. And then the one which I found to be a little bit more richer but lesser known is Faith and Logic, and that's by Basil Mitchell. And then you have the other contributors here, and you got Crombie, Farr, Stead, Lucas, Hare, and Foster. All the people who contributed to this anthology were Socratic Club participants. And both books make it clear that many of the papers were discussed at the club first. And this one didn't fare as, Faith and Logic didn't fare as well as New Essays in Philosophy of Religion. But that's because the Flew and MacIntyre anthology got picked up in America when I've looked at its publishing history. And unknown to a lot of people is it continued to publish it, you know, in the later 50s and the 60s. And I think it was still publishing all the way up to the end of the 20th century. I'd have to dig up my notes to give you the actual date. So that was another contribution.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.